My strongest memory of the neighborhood library of my childhood is how the librarian would paste stickers on a page for each book we read during summer vacation. That and the smell of the book, sort of musty. Computer terminals and CD-ROMs will never replace that smell, but they may replace the rest of the library. I'm Jude Tillman, and this is the Communications Revolution. Have you looked for a book at your local library lately? If you have, there's a good chance you spent more time at a computer terminal than wandering in the stacks. The talk now is of a virtual library where everything is computerized with no stacks at all, with information delivered electronically right into your home. Sounds fast, sounds easy, but does it sound free? Joining me today to talk about the future of the public library are Ken Dowland, city librarian with the San Francisco Public Library, author and historian Theodore Rozhak, and from the studios of WNYC in New York, Patricia Glass Schumann, immediate past president of the American Library Association. We'll begin our discussion with this report from Claire Schoen.
Remembering that an N is a name, a W is a word, a T is a title, you do two forward slashes in whatever the type of search you wish to perform, and then type.
It's actually easier to use an electronic product than it is a print product, and kids especially hate dealing with print indexes.
Welcome to the annual convention of the American Library Association. We're in San Francisco with librarians from across the country and around the world. On the exhibit floor are over 900 booths, displaying everything from children's books to the latest in telecommunications technology.
Uncover 2 is the overlay of the Uncover system, which allows for document delivery. You do a D.
We provide the patron or the librarian with the ability to intellectually access the materials.
Those are now do an S to stop or switch.
I mean, we can kind of bounce articles around the country at will.
What's going on here? These vendors are pitching tools for the virtual library, a new buzzword of the telecommunications industry. But what does it mean? Increasingly, information is being stored electronically in databases. They can contain anything from Shakespeare to census statistics to photos of the planet. And with computers, phone lines, and satellites, libraries can now plug you into vast and interlocking networks of databases, bringing the information directly into your hands. In the library of the future, you can get information from anywhere, anytime.
The amount of personal time that you have to do things is becoming shorter and shorter as society becomes accelerated. So
the patron's going to be standing at the terminal in the library, and it might say, do you want to order this article? And say, yes. And it would say, do you want to charge it to your Visa or your MasterCard? You type in your card number, okay, and then there it is, that fast.
We may be seeing that more and more, the librarian becoming more of an operator, if you will, assisting electronic searchers of data, but not necessarily required in the physical presence.
Marian.
Not required in the physical presence?
Madam Librarian.
What will happen to the neighborhood librarian, who has always been our teacher and guide through the world of books?
Oh, what can I say, my dear, to make it clear? I need you badly, badly, Madam Librarian. Marian, heaven help us if the library caught on fire and the volunteer hose brigade men had to whisper the news to Marian.
In the age of the virtual library, the librarian's role is changing, along with the institution of the library itself. With a personal computer and modem in your home, plugged into a network and database, direct access to digitally stored and processed information can be achieved without the need for obsolete human interface or book storage edifice. There's only one problem. Who knows how to make this stuff work? That's where librarians come in.
I think that without the kind of training that librarians have about helping people find information, then what we will have is this digital world in which you either sink or swim.
That's Howard Rheingold, editor of the Whole Earth Review. He says most people don't have access to a computer, let alone the knowledge of how to use one.
What about the citizen on the street? What about school children? What about the people who didn't have the education, who don't have the money to have access to a personal computer? The question is, who's going to be excluded from it, and what are you going to do about that? Public libraries might be the place where you could go for free to sit down in front of a terminal, have someone who speaks your language show you how to get started.
Not many librarians know the language of the Pomo Indian tribe of Mendocino County, California. But members of the tribe can now see and hear their own history on a special computer archive at the County Library in Ukiah. Steve Sisler, a librarian for Apple Computers, was a consultant to the Native American Memory Project.
What we're looking at is a color computer screen with a series of small postage stamp size images. And there's pictures of obsidian blades, of other hunting tools, of material for making jewelry, of headdresses and so forth.
Sisler is looking for hunting songs and stories of Stephen Knight, a Yokaia Pomo.
And what we can do is use the computer mouse to click on one of the images, something like, say, deer hunting, and it will bring up larger pictures as well as the audio clip, and it will start playing it.
If you see deer way off in the distance, you don't try to sneak on that deer. You sit down, take it easy, and start singing. And that deer will hear you sing, and pretty soon he'll start move toward you. The song just draws him on.
But there's another vision of the digital library and the librarian of the future, quite different from this portrait of open access. Howard Besser is a specialist in new information systems at the Library School of UC Berkeley. University libraries, with their vast collections of research materials to be organized and searched, have led the way in deploying online and digital information systems. But these powerful new tools exact a price.
With libraries shrinking budgets, and they're continuing to shrink enormously, we're increasingly passing on costs to the end user in the library.
Unlike the books and journals they replace, the new information systems often require a fee. It's changing the face of the library. Dr. Kenneth Cruz is Associate Professor of Business Law at San Jose State University. At State, a contract with the database company restricts who may use the service, and the librarians are the policemen.
You take your card, your university card, student ID, faculty ID, and you prop it up in a little stand on top of the computer so that it's plainly visible to the librarian who's overseeing that machine. If the card's not there, you're asked to turn the machine off and move on.
Traditionally, librarians have been the custodians of a commonly held resource, and they've prided themselves on offering equal access to all. But the library of the future could be a place you go to use private information services for a fee. In short, an information store. And so the digital library presents us with a paradox. Instead of the library of the future, we may have a future virtually without libraries. I'm Claire Schoen for the Communications Revolution.
The world of the virtual library, or a world virtually without libraries, or maybe something in between. We're going to talk now about the new role of the library in the telecommunications age. I'm Jude Tillman, and with me are Ted Rozsak, author of The Voice of the Earth, and certainly a frequent user of the library. Ken Dowland is also here in the studio. He came to the San Francisco Public Library from one of the most electronically sophisticated libraries in the U.S., in Colorado, and he's working to transform San Francisco in a similar direction. Joining us from New York, Patricia Glass Schumann is the recent past president of the American Library Association, and she's an activist on behalf of free speech and information access. Thank you all for being here.
Pat Schumann, let's start with you. What role do you see libraries playing in the future? Let me put it a little more bluntly. Do we need libraries at all anymore?
Jude, I think we need libraries more than ever, particularly with the changes that technology are bringing to us. Libraries are a very radical idea, you know, the distribution of information to everyone, regardless of income, sex, class, race. It's the one educational institution that's open to everyone. I think that the role of libraries and librarians will be very much the same. Technology is changing our methods and the way we look at things. We're moving from a way we looked at just ownership of information to access to information. Technology can offer us broad ways to access information for people, but it also has real potential for limiting information if we're not careful. Libraries are the one agency that are really dedicated to safeguarding the public's right to know.
All right. At the risk of overstating it, I think Pat just said it's the one educational institution open to everyone. I would say the public schools fall in that category as well, but certainly the point is well taken that this is a tool of democracy.
Public schools are limited by age.
Right. You're right. You're absolutely right. Ken Dowlin, what is the democratic potential for these new library technologies?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to understand that the public library is the hallmark of democracies. Public libraries have never flourished or almost even existed in dictatorial societies, in that there's almost a one-to-one relationship between a democracy and the health of a public library. So in a symbolic sense, I think it's a very strong statement of a nation's or community's commitment to democracy and the institutions and vehicles, if you will, that are essential to make that happen.
Well, what is it about the technologies that's going to enhance their democratic potential?
Well, I think the technology, first of all, I'd like to say that technology seldom displaces earlier technology. It's additive. And in fact, the television did not do away with the radio. The radio did not do away with the newspapers. The newspapers did not do away with books. And you can go all of that. And so, to a large degree, what we hear talk about the library becoming an electronic library and that whole discussion, and I personally think that's, even though I wrote a book titled The Electronic Library, which Pat Schumann published, as I talked to more and more audiences throughout the world about that subject, I reached the conclusion that the electronic library, A, in the public sector, will not happen within my lifetime and perhaps not even the next century. What we need to consider is the fact that a library is a neographic institution. In fact, I made that word up.
What does it mean?
Well, the library deals with all technologies, and we deal with them simultaneously. The issue of whether a library is a book place or not, the battle was over when libraries bought their first magazine, bought their first microfilm, mm-hmm. bought their first whatever. Mm-hmm. And we deal with videos and CDs and so on. So to us, our challenge is how do we integrate these and how do we optimize the particular technology. So in many respects, that becomes a technical nature. And if we go back to what we consider our basic function or mission in a library, and in San Francisco we define that fairly specifically as to provide free and equal access to information, knowledge, independent learning, and the joy of reading for our diverse community, there's a very important role for all technologies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so far we don't see many changes with the electronic library. Ted Rozsak, let's bring you into the conversation. Your view of the new electronic library as a frequent user, if you will.
I should make it clear in the background of everything I have to say, there's, I think, a healthy appreciation for this new technology, the electronic technologies. I mean, I use them as a writer and as a teacher. In the foreground, there's a lot of caution, and the caution connects with a couple of specific points. First of all, there's a general cautionary remark I think always has to be made about new technologies, and it has to do with the fact that we're not dealing simply with a technology, but with commodities in the marketplace. And so they tend to be surrounded by a lot of hype. I often find that in discussions of these subjects, it's hard for me to tell after a certain point, to say 30 seconds into the discussion, whether we're talking about fact, fiction, fantasy, hallucination, wishful thinking. I mean, you can get people to say this technology can do anything on up to saving your soul. So you have to be very careful about the overselling that goes with the technology. What can it actually do? It can do a lot, but it can't do everything.
Well, let's talk about what it can do. But I would like to, on that cautionary note, and you mentioned the word marketplace, Ted Rozhak. I think that's an important aspect of this, the changes that we're seeing in the library. Bruce Sterling is a science fiction writer and a science journalist who spoke at the American Library Association conference this past summer. He sounds the same sort of cautionary notes about libraries becoming business. Here's Bruce Sterling.
Welcome to the Library of Congress. Jolt Cola is the official drink of the Library of Congress. This is our distributed electronic data network brought to you by Prodigy Services, a joint venture of IBM and Sears. You'll notice a banner of bright red ads that spooled by your eyeballs while you're trying to access the electronic full text of William Wordsworth. Try to pay no attention to that. Incidentally, there's a hypertext link here where you can order our Wordsworth t-shirt and have it billed to your credit card. Did I mention that the Library of Congress is now also a bank? Hey, data is data. Digits are digits. Every pixel in cyberspace is a potential sales opportunity. Be sure to visit our library coffee bar, too. You can rent videos here if you want. We do souvenir umbrellas, ashtrays, earrings, fridge magnets, the works. We librarians are doing what we can to survive this economically difficult period.
Economically difficult period. Pat Schumann, do we have any choice?
Sadly, I have to say, you know, there is a bill before the Congress of the United States right now, which, if passed, would allow the Library of Congress to charge fees for new technological services. The library community is quite opposed to that, particularly the American Library Association, but that science fiction is not far from the truth. But I think it was Theodore Ozak that said, you know, there's a lot of hype going on here. I think libraries adopting a business agenda is a very dangerous game because it means we follow the marketplace rather than forging our own agenda. And, you know, libraries have always been about equity. Business is about efficiency. The marketplace is about efficiency. They're very different things. People will say, well, we don't have any money and this is the only way we can finance services. But, you know, in this country, all library all funds for libraries equal less than 0.2% of all taxes, and they serve 66% of the public. It's the best bargain in public services this country has. And if we turn libraries into businesses, we're going to lose what is really a national treasure. And the really interesting thing is, you know, I think Ken Dowland mentioned it, I happened to be in Moscow during the coup at a library meeting. But it was very interesting because the first thing East European countries are trying to do is to emulate our system of public libraries.
Mm-hmm. Ken Dowland, realistically, Ken Dowland, what Pat Schumann was just saying sounds great. You want to be very wary of becoming businesses and the logic that would be involved with that, niche markets, not serving the public, that sort of thing. But libraries have already been charging fees for all kinds of things, videos, online services, to download databases, fees for reserving books or for interlibrary library loans, for example. The electronic virtual library offers an opportunity for libraries to become financially solvent. Isn't that true?
I would not go that far. I don't think that libraries would ever generate a significant amount of revenue to solve our infrastructure budget problems that are going on. I think it's key, and the reason I brought up the mission of the library, for libraries to understand or clarify and be able to articulate the role that they have. One of the things we forget, we have a tendency, and I think the media is among the worst, to lump all libraries together as if we were McDonald's franchises. The library, the public library, one of its major strengths is we are of the community we serve. We had a major issue of that yesterday in the Library Commission of San Francisco, where we resisted censorship attempts, primarily from out of state, to force their values onto the library, and the commission said that that is not appropriate for San Francisco. So that we are of our community, and then mission and our purpose in our community may differ from library to library, but I think we all share the common goal and the professional goal, if you will, of enhancing people's access to information, knowledge, and learning, and mm-hmm. the vehicles for that.
Well, information, knowledge, learning, I mean, these are fine abstract concepts, but in concrete reality,
There's a difference, Ted Rozhak, isn't there, between the data that the libraries are increasingly providing to, say, corporate users or even institutional users, members of academia like yourself, and the general knowledge that people want from the library. Isn't that true?
There's a rather deep philosophical problem that usually gets glossed over in these discussions, and the library may have a very special role to play in solving that problem or helping people solve it. There's a tendency, you can see it in this discussion we're having here, to keep using the word information as if we know what we're talking about. The fact is, information needs to be very carefully defined. You hear most people talk about information, including librarians, sometimes you might feel that there's not much difference between a telephone book and Plato or Shakespeare. The fact that you can digitalize an awful lot of things is about as meaningful as the fact that you could reduce a lot of literature to ink. Nobody ever talked about having an ink culture in the past. And to say that we now have an information culture simply because you can turn everything into digital bits and pieces is really quite trivial. And what that does is that it flattens everything into some one thing called information so that there is not a distinction about those things that are properly called information, rigorously defined, and I prefer a rigorous definition of information, as distinct from knowledge, as distinct from judgment, as distinct from wisdom, as distinct from beauty. And it seems to me that librarians, as living human beings that deal with people who come to them asking questions about God knows what, everything, you know, from telephone numbers to what am I... how am I going to get through the night and live through the next day, and what's the meaning of my life, and so on. The librarian might be that humanistic element in the system that points out these distinctions to people, that sometimes what you want you can get out of a database, and sometimes what you want, well, you can only get it out of a good book that you can take with you into the woods and read at length, and that these are distinctions in life, these are distinctions in culture. The main problem I see at a philosophical level about information technology is that we are flattening everything into some one thing called information, and that impoverishes us. And this is not to say information isn't important. It is, but it's not the most important thing in any culture. Mm-hmm. Indeed, I would defend the proposition, as I have in books I've written, that information is one of the least important things in any culture, and you can even do without it.
All right. On that note, let's talk about the humanistic element that you so eloquently speak of, Ted Rozhak. A lot of the hustle-bustle of the American Library Association conference this last summer had to do with how information brokers, big corporations, could come in and sell their services to libraries. And there's an allure, isn't there, Pat Schumann, for librarians to upgrade their status and become
info brokers? Oh, I think that's another hype. That's another hype that I think the business community is perpetrating on librarians. The Special Libraries Association a couple of years ago did a study on the image of librarians, which we in the profession are always very concerned with, and they had a whole list of titles from librarian to information manager to information broker to information scientist. They surveyed community leaders, newspaper reporters, and you know what they found out? The only title people really understood was the word librarian. So I think, you know, some people look at it as a way to glorify the status of librarians, and I think there is a lot of hype. I would agree with Mr. Rozhak about information. There's also a lot of hype to say that all information will be digitalized. Do you know 5 companies control 90% of the sales and uses of database in this country?
And then how
it's
are
a
we
very scary prospect when you talk about all information being available electronically. Mm-hmm. There are very few people making decisions about what information will be available commercially.
Well, Ken Dallin, whether we're talking about information or knowledge, the fact that we can make it available electronically, what does that really mean in terms of a person's ability to use this material? I mean, we heard in the top of the hour, M is for name, W is for word, 2 forward slashes. I mean, this is complicated stuff. How are you going to make this stuff accessible for users, for the average person?
Well, obviously, it's an evolving continuum of working with the users to come up with systems that they can use. At the same time, the kids who are in elementary school now are learning how to deal with keyboards and my mouses. I don't know, are they mouses or mice, whatever. And so on. There's over a period of time that will become somewhat less of an issue. But Pat touched on it, and I kind of wanted to just bring out There are two really major elements that I think that the library has a very special role. One is what I alluded to earlier, was the sense of community. One of my concerns with the electronic information MailU is virtually there are 6,000, 7,000 or 10,000 databases available today to you or anybody else who has
a computer and knows how to use it, the tools
and a contract.
Well, that's a limit.
None of them are on San Francisco. None of them are on your hometown. None of them are on your hometown.
Where are they?
They do not exist because the marketplace to create these are either national or global. And so there is no financial incentive for the developers to do that. And I would contend that is a key role for the public library to preserve that community element in this knowledge, information, data stream, because I would say virtually no one else is doing that. Mm-hmm. The public library is an institution who not only serves all generations simultaneously, but we serve defined communities, our cities, our counties, and so on. And that I worry about that if libraries do not do that, it will not happen.
You know, here in Berkeley, we've had a library that's sought to be a sort of an ombudsman for the disadvantaged. There is no database called JoblessNet or PauperServe. That kind of information tends not to become electronic.
Right.
You have to find it on scraps of paper and brochures and leaflets and flyers and so on. And I know Berkeley is among the cities that has tried to provide that service for that public, which is a very large public in our society.
Right. Well, the other dimension to that, I like to characterize the library's roles as dealing with the past, the present, and the future. In the past, I would contend we need to be the cultural anchor in the electronic age, that we connect to our historic resources and incorporate the electronics. In the present, I say we need to be the community institution. And the future, I think, really leads into the concept of the global library.
We're talking about how new telecommunications technologies are changing the role of the public library and, in fact, whether the public library is going to be accessible for regular people in the future to use. My guests are Patricia Glass-Schumann, the immediate past president of the American Library Association and a frequent testifier before Congress on right to information legislation. Ken Dowlin is the San Francisco City Librarian who has led in the fight to fund new electronic systems. And Ted Rozsak is a noted social historian and critic who has raised concerns about the new high-tech information services in the library. This is the Communications Revolution. By the way, if you have full internet access, you can join the discussion of this topic on our IRC channel. The channel name is TRP. To get there, type IRC and return, then type /join %TRP. Be patient. We'll see you there.
The Communications Revolution is produced at KPFA, Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, with funds from the Telecommunications Education Trust, established by the California Public Utilities Commission. It's distributed by Pacifica National Programming. The producer and managing editor is Alan Smithow. The associate producer is Carol Klinger. The executive producer is Barry Scott. For a cassette tape or a written transcript of this program, call the Pacifica Radio Archive at 1-800-735-0230 and ask for the Communications Revolution, Program 494. This is the Communications Revolution. This edition of the Communications Revolution was originally broadcast at an earlier date. The phone calls and the discussion that follow are pre-recorded.
My guests are Ken Dowlin, City Librarian with the San Francisco Public Library. Ken is developing new electronic information services for users of the public library system here in the Bay Area. Ted Rozsak is the author of The Cult of Information and The Voice of the Earth. He raises questions regarding the benefits of electronic information and what it means for access. And Pat Schumann is the recent president of the American Library Association. She's especially concerned about the availability of government information. Let's take our first caller now, Valerie from Berkeley. You're on the Communications Revolution.
Hi. Yes, my question has to deal with all these numbers and words and digits and electronics and things. How does this all transform our lives to make it our lives better, really? That's what I'm interested in. Is there any thing that says this is going to help us in some big way?
Thank you, Valerie, for your call. A very good question. Ken Dallin, how is this helping people's lives improve, all this technology?
Well, I think we're talking about electronic computer-type telecommunications technology. There's a whole issue of technology as a whole. I mean, people forget that bicycles are a technology, running shoes are a technology, all of those things. And I think a case can be made that, for example, I'm a bicycle fan. I think they've improved my life tremendously. But in terms of access to information, I think to a large degree, the major impact comes through the multiplicity of channels that are available to you now. And I think that has been a major change in the communications technology. In the old days, whatever those were, we had three national television networks, we had a handful of radio networks and so on. So there were a limited number of channels available. The technology, whether it's CDs or VCRs or whatever, cable television, have given you many, many more choices to have access.
Isn't it true, Ken Dallin, those choices are only available for people who have computers or know how to use them? I mean, how much libraries are shutting down, never mind having computer equipment
well,
installed?
Well, there are still a lot of libraries left in this country.
Right.
And for example, one of the things, the technology, some people call me a techno-Luddite, but I do think technology can bring us many advantages if we're careful about it. For example, the National Library of Medicine is online. I have heard, hundreds of stories of people being able to search that database and find, a specific doctor specializing in a thing and to be able to research a disease, for example.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we're fighting for in the American Library Association is to be able to access government databases, which has all kinds of information that we can use in our daily lives about nutrition, about health, about the environment. The government has a right to know toxic release inventory database now, which it's putting in libraries. And you can actually go and research what toxic waste are being put into your community.
Pat, when you say
companies are doing that,
when you say government information access databases, how would the average person who all of a sudden is concerned about a toxic dump down the block, what would they step by step tell us how that would work? How would they access this
information?
Well,
they would probably first step go to their local library and ask if they have the toxic release inventory database. If they don't, they would ask their local librarian where the depository library for that region is. There are 1,400. Libraries in the United States designated as depository libraries, which means they are supposed to get all copies of information published by the government. One of the battles we're facing now with the government is what is the definition of publication.
Mm-hmm.
And on an experimental basis, they're making some technological products available to libraries, but we still have not won the battle of getting electronic access to government databases.
All right, we're seeing problems from both ends, both making the information available from the government or wherever, and problems, I want to concentrate on the user end for a few minutes. In the earlier setup piece that we listened to, they talked about, okay, if you want this information that you're seeing on your screen, enter your Visa or MasterCard. This, again, seems to connote that this is a very well-to-do or middle-class clientele that's going to be using this technology. What if you don't have a Visa or MasterCard?
Well, that's the very reason why I don't believe that libraries have any business being in business. Libraries are a public service agency. And while it's true that they have traditionally charged fees for photocopies, for fines, and what are they, 20 cents a piece, I don't know how many of your listeners have tried to search a database lately, but that's more like $25 an hour.
But as you noted yourself, Pat, fewer and fewer people are providing the information, and it seems to be for niche markets. So in effect, you're saying taxpayers, that is public money from the government, should go to support information that right now is largely tailored for specialized clientele. Is that not true?
Well,
no, I don't think I would quite put it that way. What I'm talking about is information collected, stored, and digitized at taxpayers' expense that ought to be available to the taxpayer without the taxpayer having to pay a charge for it. Government information isn't copyrighted. The business community is welcome to add all the bells and whistles they want. The question now is the public can't even get basic access to, for example, census data
mm-hmm.
that used to be available in print form. Some of it's now available only on a database, and it's only available from the private sector for a fee. That's stuff that our tax dollars are paid for.
All right, let's take
that's creating information haves and have-nots, depending on whether you can afford to access information from your own government.
Ken, you want to jump in here?
Well, that's a key issue, and the debate rages in the library community over that. I have somewhat a little different cut on the perspective, in that I do think it is feasible and defensible for a library to charge for convenience, and in some cases added value. We have the taxpayers in San Francisco put up X number of dollars every year for the library service. That is prepaid library service, and we will provide those functions for which they traditionally have felt that they have paid for, and we're very committed to that. On the other hand, I think it is feasible to charge for convenience. If you want to check out a book, you can come to the library, check out that book free, take it home. If you want that book transmitted to your desktop at a particular time, like in the next 5 minutes, I think we can charge for that. And I think we can charge for that in a way that subsidizes the access of the people who cannot pay for that.
All right, Rita from Clear Lake, you're on the Communications Revolution.
Hello. I would like to make a philosophical question that has to do with my personal opinion is that I would not like to see any central authorities trying to distribute or regulate or determine what kind of information is made available. Right now, I think it's very exciting at Frontier sort of atmosphere where the information which is available is mostly determined by how many downloads, that is to say, how many people want to view such information. And in that, I would like to also say that I've got articles published or uploaded in the Elections Forum on America Online and the Nonprofit Connection on Genie, which is some very relevant things that you won't even hear on KPFA. And I'm really disturbed by the trend. It's one thing to get the information from the government, and it's another thing to talk about, well, let's have this central library program. So why don't we address both of these as two separate issues and not try to lump it together?
Thank you very much for your comment and your question, Rita. Any response from the panelists here?
I don't think we've been talking. Interestingly enough, the United States is one of the few countries in the world that does not, in essence, have a national library. The Library of Congress, although it performs some national functions, is really the Library of Congress. I don't think anybody has been talking about a centralized system. What we're talking about is trying to get access to information by and about us that our government is letting the private sector sell at a great profit. Now, no one wants to stop the private sector from doing that, but what we want is basic access for the public.
All right, another call now. Charles from Richmond, you're on the Communications Revolution.
Hello.
Go ahead, Charles.
Yes, I was wondering a couple of things. One, this technology is racing ahead, and there's a core of people who've learned to use it, but what programs are being created that is going to bring the public in general into the system where to teach them how to access information electronically?
We have a very sad state in this country. You know, one out of four Americans can't even read a book. I think that's going to take a lot of public investment and a lot of cooperation between libraries, the education community, and possibly partnerships with the business community. But you know, it's a grave necessity. But you know, we have a 30% dropout rate in New York in our high schools.
Can
so when we talk about computers.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's my great fear. Ken, how are you training people to use these?
Well, at the present time, we don't have the online catalogs out, but that will be early after the first of the year, and obviously people will need assistance in working with the technology and locating the material. In some cases, though, people almost assume that all of us were born with the ability to use a card catalog, and in fact, that has taken years, if not decades, to try to understand how to use that particular technology. So it's an ongoing process for the library to train, support, and that's a major issue, I think, of as we move into more technology orientation, that where do people go for training and the access mode? But I see it as a continuation of what we've done for a long time.
Actually, you know, this question, which comes up frequently, might be one of the easiest questions to to deal with, one of the easiest problems to solve. That is, if we saw our way clear to making the public library a people's information service, then and if it had the resources to do that, meaning the people, the machines, everything it needs for that purpose, people might be able to do what I do. I'm a university professor. I don't search databases. I don't have any interest in learning that skill. What I do is I ask librarians to do it for me. I know what I need to know. I tell them what I need to know. I depend upon them to do the job. And I think that is one of the roles the library could provide. It could be that intermediary between a very complex technology that requires great skill, far more skill than I want to acquire in order to use it myself, and the public that needs, perhaps needs that information, often does need it very urgently. The library could be that, and you would not have to go to private information brokers to provide this service for you.
And Ted, have you had success in asking your local librarian to...
Well, I've used a couple of public library database services over the years for my writing. That is, when I get finished with a book, for example, about 10% of what I put into a book is information. The rest is out of books that I read in my own home, thinking, that sort of thing. But you come down finally, if you're writing nonfiction, you need some information. And I usually, if it's hard to find, if it's more trouble than I can take, I turn it over to an information search in my library. There have been a couple here in California, one in Southern California, an L.A. public library called the Southern California Answering Network. We used to have one in the Bay Area called the Bay Area Reference Center, and I found that they were marvelous to work with.
All right, you're listening to The Communications Revolution. Our subject is the library, the new virtual library, electronic library, whatever you want to call it. What are libraries going to do in the future when their materials go online? Our guests today are Pat Schumann. She's a former president of the American Library Association. Ted Rozsak was just speaking. He's a frequent user of the library and social historian. And Ken Dowlin is also with us. He is from the San Francisco Public Library. Let's take another call now. We have Paul from Oakland. You're on the Communications Revolution.
Yes. I was wondering if your panel could talk about the French approach with the Minitel system, where basically the phone company gave each one of their customers a modem and computer for home use.
That's a very good question, because in fact, some people have suggested that libraries shouldn't be providing this electronic information. We should use something that's already in place, such as telephone lines. What do you say, Ken Dowlin?
Well, first of all, you have to remember the telephone company in France is run by the national government, and they made it a public policy to provide Minitel terminals in lieu of telephone books, and right there it reached the critical mass to have enough utility in the home. They made it simple in terms of the technology to use. And its primary use is still looking up telephone numbers. In the United States, we don't have that vehicle. We have no way to decree in Washington that everybody will use these things. So here in the United States, the Minitel is simply, as far as my perspective, the same as a Prodigy service, as the public or the things you can sign up for and get particular services. The real issue from a library perspective, and I have there is a program here through that is somewhat supported by Pacific Bell to implement the Minitel program here, and from my perspective, that's the same thing as the Prodigy and the other services that are available. From our perspective, is when they reach the critical mass of users that justifies our being a information provider on the system, then we will probably do it, but we would do that with any information provider. France has
we're talking about methods of transmission,
right,
and not actually what is communicated. My understanding in France, too, is that Minitel is not really being used for information services, that most of the use is on pornographic data.
Well, that's news
to
me.
That's what I have read, except for the phone book. You know, most of the general public is not particularly interested in using information services per se. When they need to know something, then they will think of it, but it's not
right
necessarily, you know, the phone is a transparent thing, and that's one more way that you can access information when you need it. But, you know, there are those of us who are junkies and, you know, can access Prodigy or CompuServe every day, but most of the public is never going to do that.
I see. Well, to be fair to Minitel, my understanding is that, people were able to do grocery shopping and that sort of thing as well from their home via a computer terminal.
Well, that's been the real dream for the marketers, if you will. And the United States has had a number of cable television experiments. The Cube experiment in Columbus, Ohio put millions and millions of dollars into that. And there have been a number of those, Prodigy. And their big hope is that they will make this financially feasible through marketing services.
And you'll never have to leave your house.
And you'll never have to leave your house. To be honest, I think it will not fly because, well, I mean, with my wife, going shopping is a social experience as well as a utilitarian one. So, and I go along too. So there are a lot of dimensions to that. To me, the basic reason in the United States that the online interactive information systems have not become economically feasible is because they are so limited in what they can provide. They are not neographic. They're single. They only have one dimension. That's electronic transfer. And at the same time, almost all of those have no history. In other words, they were created the day they were started and moved forward. They do not go back.
All right. Neil from Eureka, you're on the Communications Revolution.
Hi.
Neil, go ahead. Do you have a question?
I haven't really thought this through terribly, but I'm sensitive to the idea of putting a library in the center of the city. I lived in San Francisco for 20 years, and I probably only went to the main library 10 times because, for me, it was a major hassle. And I wondered why, with the technology that we have today, one wouldn't consider putting reference terminals in shopping centers, in small branch libraries, as opposed to putting a whole lot of money in a big building next to City Hall.
A very good point, Neil. What about the physical structure of the library? Do we need it at all? Should we be putting terminals in gas stations and supermarkets? Or what's the future of this space as you see it? Pat Schumann?
Well, I think there are two questions there. One is the location of the building, and the other is whether we need a building. You know, libraries are important public buildings in most communities. And in fact, you know, they're defaced more often than we like, but they're buildings that people respect and use for all kinds of things in addition to just accessing a terminal or checking out a book. They use them for community meetings. They use them to meet their friends. We use them for story hours for kids. You know, students have club meetings. There's all kinds of public community reasons to have a library building. The idea of the large urban public library building, you know, that's a question, and I guess I would throw that over to Ken Dowen, who's building one right there, and ask him, you know, why,
well,
at this point in time, has the city of San Francisco decided to put the money there instead of branches?
Well, this gives me sort of two dimensions, if you will. One is to point out, in San Francisco, although we're investing in technology, it's a small portion of what we're investing in buildings and collections and staffing, a very small fraction of what we put into this. But the issue, and I used to use all the reasons why we needed libraries as a social experience, as a communication center, all of that, as well as a warehouse. And actually, over the years, I've got boiled it down very simply. The reason we will continue to have major library buildings or library buildings in the future is because the public wants them. In fact, we have a Gallup poll that shows that the public still supports libraries and they want them. In San Francisco, we know that 90% of the citizens of San Francisco feel that the public library is a worthwhile institution, not a waste of money that could be better used elsewhere. And 77% of them voted in 1988 to build a new main library at $140 million, which will be one of the large ones. So the public wants them. They see them for their social value, but I think they also see them as an icon for their society and for their democracy.
Mm-hmm. All right, another call now. Eric, also from Eureka. You're on the Communications Revolution. Eric?
Right. A while back, the FBI asked the Librarians Association, actually individual libraries, to make available lists of books that were checked out by, or for the right to make available lists of books that were checked out by individuals. That was an alarming idea. The Librarians Association decided to go on record opposing that concept, as I understand it.
That's right.
Now
went bonkers, in fact.
And I'm glad to hear that. Now you have mentioned that the government has decided to make or is deciding right now whether or not to make information that has in the past been generally publicly available no longer available, or available only through limited channels. In the sense that a library has historically been a place where freedom might reign supreme, and in fact, to the extent that it's rather radical, you give people the opportunity to use ideas and have information without even paying a copyright to the person that created the idea. It's one of the few places in our society where that happens. How are the librarians going to work to make sure that ideas that people did pay for, that the government collected, ideas and information, remain available to people? And also, a subset of that, how can the public work with the librarians to accomplish that? I'd like to hear some comments on that, if I may. Well, thank you.
That's a very good question. I think the library community has been extremely concerned and has been lobbying hard in Washington, and we have testified, we have formed a coalition on government information, but we are facing a very big information industry that is extremely powerful and is growing.
Now, I wonder if you couldn't take it as a rule of thumb. I mean, we talk so much about the value of information these days, and we are a data-intensive society because of the nature of our business community. I wonder if you couldn't take it as a rule of thumb that the more valuable information becomes, the less likely it is to be given away. That is, it becomes the basis for somebody making a profit. And profit means restricting either by cost or by license or by copyright. It seems to me one of the roles the library has to play in this is almost an adversarial one. It is a public service as opposed to a market institution. And so one of the roles of the library is to fight to keep the information accessible, almost in spite of a technology which tends to be privatizing a great deal of public information. Previously public information. So that gives the library a special role as a democratic institution in an information economy, as we call it, which is more and more being run by profit in fewer and fewer hands.
Irving from Mill Valley, you're on the communications revolution.
Hello?
Yes, Irving, go ahead.
My question was, particularly since this is all depersonalized, hard to judge that, how does one distinguish between misinformation, disinformation, considering, for example, that our government and its helpers just poured out disinformation all over the world recently to turn things around?
It's certainly an interesting question. It connected to the larger one of who controls the content of all this information that the library is going to be making available, hopefully, in the future.
Well, I think part of that is going back to the earlier statement that we feel in the library field a major part of our function is advocacy, to advocate access, the legal right to have information produced by the government. I think the problem comes when the information gets filtered or held back or buried or what have you. And our basic approach, personally, I don't have all the answers to all the problems in the world, nor would I be so elitist to say that I'm the only person who could do that. On the other hand, I think multiple channels and availability enhances people's ability to make conscious decisions between right and wrong and what is real and what isn't.
The optimist viewpoint, and I have to point out that runs somewhat contrary to what Ted Rozak was saying a minute ago about how librarians, it's incumbent upon them to keep information available almost in spite of the technology. So we're exploring today not just the notion of what the information is, its content, etc., but how the technology influences that availability.
Well, it's very important also that people understand that just because information and large bodies of information available technology, that is not all the information that there is. That's one of the things we find, that's very frightening. And one of the roles of libraries, I think, is what Ken Dallin was saying, is it has always provided multiple channels.
Mm-hmm.
We see the private sector channels really shrinking. Elsevier and Reed International just merged to make a $500 billion company. That's bigger than the revenue streams of most governments. They will, control a large part of magazine publishing in the world. Libraries will provide those journals when they can afford them, but they will also provide other sources of information. That's one of the great things about libraries is the diversity.
All right, we have only a few minutes left, but Chuck from Mountain View has been very patient and has a question about a specific service. Chuck?
Hi. Just to expand a little bit upon some of the thoughts of the previous callers on intellectual property and copyrights and some of the comments you've been making, I've recently read a book and seen Ted Nelson speak on his vision.
Very quickly, Chuck.
Yes. The book is called Literary Machines, and he's developing a system called Xanadu, and I was just wondering if your panel has heard of that and what if they've heard any status of it in comments. I haven't heard in a while.
Does anyone know about Xanadu?
Well,
I've read it, but it was a couple of years ago.
To some degree, I think the Xanadu project is a little bit like the Shangri-La project. That may be more vaporware at this stage in a concept.
You've just lost me, Ken.
It's a very interesting concept. I would be very surprised that it ever became generally operationalized.
All right.
Interesting concept.
All right, interesting concept that unfortunately we don't have time to explore. I'll have to ask about that another time. We are out of time for this week. Just speaking was Ken Dowlin. He's here from the San Francisco Public Library. Our thanks also to Ted Rozak, who joins us here in the KPFA studio, and Pat Schumann joining us from WNYC in New York. Additional feature music was provided for this show by Don Swearingen, and our thanks to Bob O'Neill for his help at WNYC. For the Communications Revolution, I'm Jude Tillman. Thanks for listening.
The Communications Revolution is directed by John Rieger. The technical consultant is Tim Pozar. Our on-air engineer is Jim Bennett. Indigo Sum is the administrative assistant. Music created by Tony Kniff. You can receive a free resource list for today's program by sending a stamped self-addressed envelope to Pacifica Radio Archives, Post Office Box 8092, Universal City, California, 91608. Ask for program 494. This is the Communications Revolution.
Next time on the Communications Revolution, telemedicine. It's touted by private companies who want in on information superhighway profits. Is this just hype aimed at our healthcare anxieties? Or does telecommunications technology hold genuine promise for American medicine? Medicine on the net, next time on the Communications Revolution.